Normally, I begin by asking you if you have any pressing questions of a halachic nature. This is halacha, and I want to begin with questions today. I want to do that at the end because I'm afraid I won't get to the really important stuff that I really want to do. So first I want to cover briefly one or two important points about Yom Kippur, the day of the great fast, which is coming up on Friday night and Saturday, you know, and I want to cover one or two very important things, and then we can deal with questions. Here's the idea. Everyone knows that sakanat nifashot, threat to life, sets aside almost all halachic prohibitions. It is correct to violate Shabbos. It is correct to eat chametz on Pesach, to violate Yom Kippur. It is correct to set aside just about all halachic prohibitions in order to save someone's life. There are, of course, only three exceptions. I suppose this is well known. You're not allowed to kill someone to save someone's life. Not allowed to commit the sin of idolatry to save someone's life. And adultery and sexual violations are also prohibited, even in life-saving situations. But all, you know, these exceptions are fairly rare, Baruch Hashem, at least nowadays. And the common situation is, therefore, pikuach nefesh, life-saving, which permits eating and drinking on Yom Kippur to save someone's life. Now, the problem is fundamentally a religious problem. I know we don't normally talk about religion in the context of halacha, but sometimes we have no choice, and the religious ideas impinge upon halacha as well. Think about it for a moment. Someone is sick with, I don't care what disease, you know, viral inflammation of who knows what, and the question therefore arises, is this medical condition life-threatening? Is the person likely to die if the person fasts for 26 hours or so, 25 hours, whatever it is? Is the fast likely to kill the person or not? Well, of course, the answer to this question is impossible to give. Only a Navi, only a prophet, is able to predict the future, and therefore no one knows definitively whether or not the patient is going to die as a result of fasting on Yom Kippur. However, from the halakhic point of view, we do not need the ability to predict the future. The reason we do not need the ability to predict the future, as far as this halacha is concerned, the reason is that safek, sakanat nefashot, a doubt, the possibility of someone being in a life-threatening situation, is halachically identical to saying someone is going to die. You don't have to know that someone is going to die in order to set aside the prohibitions of Yom Kippur, Shabbat, Pesach, and so forth and so on. All you need is the safek, the possibility that that the person is going to die. Is it okay if I use North American English? Yeah, you understand it. Okay. If you need translation, just let me know. Now, since safek, sakanas nefashos, a doubt, a possibility of a life-threatening situation also sets aside the prohibitions of Yom Kippur and all the other prohibitions except the big three. Now we have to figure out, how do you know whether or not you are confronted with a case of safek sakanas nefashos? How do we know whether this doubt exists or not? And the answer to that question is really very simple. Before I give the answer, let me just warn you that my answer disregards quantum physics. Quantum physics, which only works on very small scale that is imperceptible to ordinary senses, has nothing to do with halacha. halacha depends exclusively on phenomena which are perceptible by ordinary senses, with the ordinary eyes, your ordinary feeling, your ordinary smell, taste, and so forth. Phenomena which cannot be perceived with ordinary senses are halachically irrelevant, and therefore what I'm about to say totally and absolutely disregards quantum physics. Here goes the explanation. Suffolk, doubt, does not exist in reality. In reality, in the world around us, there is no such thing as suffolk. The meat either is kosher or it's not kosher. There's no such thing as a piece of meat which is maybe kosher. It either is or it isn't. Suffolk, doubt, does not exist in reality. Suffolk is not an element of the world around us. Suffolk, doubt, is a phenomenon of the human mind. Suffolk, doubt, exists within the human mind and only within the human mind. And therefore, the observer might not know whether a piece of meat is kosher or treif, so it's suffolk, treif. And everyone knows the rule that if you have a suffolk, a doubt regarding a Torah prohibition, you have to be strict. If you have a suffolk, a doubt regarding a rabbinic prohibition, there's a general room for leniency. Those rules become very complicated when you actually want to apply them. But those general rules are well known. The suffolk exists in the mind of the observer, and only in the mind of the observer. Therefore, on Yom Kippur, if the question is, should someone be eating and drinking because their life is being threatened? Well, who knows whether they're going to live or die? Only a prophet would know that. But we can ask the patient, assuming the patient is lucid, maybe the patient is not conscious, but assuming the patient is lucid, we can ask the patient, is there a suffolk in your mind? Do you entertain a doubt in your mind? Do you think you might die because of the condition? You know how bad you feel. You know what, you and only you know how you feel inside. Do you think this is so bad that you might die from this? And you get a yes or no answer. Now, and similarly, the observers might be medical professionals, a physician. The observers might be just ordinary Jews who are standing around. It doesn't really matter who the observers are, friend, family, medical professionals. If one of the observers has a doubt in his mind, this looks pretty bad. This looks like he might die from this. Well, if one of the observers or the patient himself has a suffolk, a doubt in his or her mind, then that is sakanat nefashot, and that justifies violating Shabbos, violating Yom Kippur, violating Pesach, whatever is necessary in order to deal with the case. Now, of course, someone might have a suffolk like this and therefore be entirely justified and entirely correct in driving off, violating Shabbos and Yom Kippur, to drive to a physician, to drive to the hospital. And you get to the hospital, someone has great chest pains. And the person says to himself, wow, this might be a heart attack. I might be dying. Or the observers see, wow, he's really suffering terribly with chest pains. That might be a heart attack. We should get him to the hospital. So it's absolutely correct and absolutely justified to violate Shabbos or Yom Kippur or whatever in order to deal with the situation. And if dealing with the situation means driving off to the emergency room in the hospital, and remember that in heart attack cases, every second counts. Every second that passes makes it more difficult for medical professionals to deal with the heart attack. And therefore, if you have a car available to drive to the hospital, you'll get there a lot quicker than waiting for an ambulance to come. And every second really counts with heart attack victims. That's terribly important. So you get to the hospital. And of course, the medical professionals will do their thing. They will diagnose the patient. And, there are a number of medical conditions which are relatively innocent, relatively harmless. There are a number of medical conditions which mimic heart attacks. Of course, the relatively innocent, the relatively minor medical conditions which imitate heart attacks are the last things they check for in the emergency room, because first they want to check for all the things which really are dangerous and really are terribly important to deal with. So let us imagine that the patient has been driven off to the hospital, and it's now been the doctors have finished their diagnosis, and they've come up with the conclusion, this is not a heart attack. This is only a relatively minor condition which happens to mimic the symptoms of heart attack. This is just a passing failure of the sphincter. At the top of your stomach, where the food goes into the stomach, there's a muscle which keeps the stomach closed. The reason there's a muscle there to keep the stomach closed, has to open to let the food in, closes to keep the food in the stomach. That's terribly important, because the contents of your stomach are highly acidic. Your stomach is built to tolerate that very acidic environment. The other parts of your thoracic cavity, the rest of your chest, the esophagus, is not built to tolerate that acid, and therefore it's very important for that muscle to keep tightly closed to keep the acids in the stomach. Some people have a temporary failure of that muscle. It weakens a little bit. A little bit of acid splashes out of the stomach, up into the esophagus, into the thoracic cavity, and that really hurts. It really hurts a lot. And you might very well think the patient is having a heart attack, which is, of course, a life-threatening condition. It's only a little bit of stomach acid which is splashed into the esophagus. That's all it is. It'll take care of itself in a few minutes. And if it's an ongoing problem of weakness in that sphincter, so the doctor will give advice to the patient how to deal with it. But it's not the sort of thing which is going to kill you. It just hurts a lot. Now once the medical staff has come to their diagnosis and they say there's no threat to life here, presumably, I hope what would happen is the patient himself and all the observers will be convinced that the physicians have the correct diagnosis, and assuming that they are convinced that the physicians have the correct diagnosis, the doubt which was previously in their minds, maybe he's going to die because of this, that suffix has now vanished, has been removed by the professional diagnosis, and now there's no longer any justification for violating Yom Kippur, Shabbos, or anything else. Of course, in some cases, I suppose it's possible that the patient or the friends and relatives might not be convinced by what the doctors say, and they still might think that there's a threat to life here. I suppose that's possible. It should probably depend upon who the doctors are. So far, so good. If there is a suffix in your mind that someone might die, then of course it's correct to eat and drink on Yom Kippur. Now, when it is correct to eat and drink on Yom Kippur because of the threat to life, of course what we want to do is minimize the amount of eating and drinking, just enough to eliminate the suffix. We should eat and drink just enough to eliminate the doubt that maybe they're going to die. Then we want to minimize the amount of eating and drinking. Now, in most cases, the overwhelming majority of cases, the threat to life is not from failure to eat. In the overwhelming majority of cases, the threat to life is from failure to drink. It is dehydration, which is, in the overwhelming majority of cases, the problem. There are, of course, a number of metabolic conditions, diabetes, metabolic conditions which require eating on Yom Kippur, but that's a fairly small number of cases. Overwhelming majority of the problem is drinking. So let's talk about drinking first when it comes to eating afterwards. As far as drinking is concerned, people who must drink on Yom Kippur in order to sustain their life should minimize drinking in the following way. Melo Lugmav, half a mouthful. Melo Lugmav, half a mouthful of fluid, Toch Kedei Achilas Pras, in the amount of time that it takes to eat a loaf of bread as they had back in the days of the Gemara. All of this translates into modern terms as follows. Half a mouthful varies, the amount, the volume of half a mouthful varies from person to person. Some people have bigger oral cavities, some people have smaller oral cavities, big mouth, small mouth, right? In order to establish your measure for half a mouthful, or in order to establish the measure of half a mouthful for the patient who's going to be drinking on Yom Kippur, before Yom Kippur, or even on Yom Kippur if this arises, the patient can fill his or her mouth with as much water as you can hold in your mouth. Now, you spit out the water into a cup. Half that amount is your measure of melo lugmav. That, if that amount will deal with the threat to life, hine matov, that's good. There's no reason to drink more than that if that small amount will work. In a typical adult mouth, of course there's a lot of variation in the size of people's mouths, but in an average adult mouth, we're talking about around 40 cubic centimeters. Around 40 cubic centimeters in a typical adult mouth is what it turns out to be. And that amount can be drunk every 9 minutes. Every 9 minutes you drink, wait another 9 minutes, drink that amount again, wait another 9 minutes, drink that amount again. You don't have to do it every 9 minutes, right? But 9 minutes is the closest that those drinkings can be together. It has to be at least 9 minutes apart, each one no more than half a mouthful. Now, in the course of Yom Kippur, this amount of fluid taken every 9 minutes adds up to a huge amount in the course of the day, and it's unusual to encounter medical problems which cannot be satisfactorily dealt with in this way. If it's not enough, it could be that there's still a suffix in your mind that this is not enough, then the amount of time can be reduced. Reduce the amount of time. If the amount of time has to be reduced to less than 4 minutes, it makes no sense to do that. If the amount of time has to be reduced to less than 4 minutes, then why don't you just drink normally then. Now, if the patient is drinking on Yom Kippur, it need not be water. It can be any liquid, milk, fruit juice. If the patient is already drinking on Yom Kippur, justified to drink, it might as well be something which has some nutritive value as well. Fruit juice has sugar in it, or milk has sugar in it as well. That's good.
Like those diabetes. We need to have.
Yeah, diabetics are a little bit different. See, in your metabolic diseases, a diabetic, surely a type 1, a juvenile onset diabetic, should have a fairly clear idea about how much he has to eat in order to avoid going into shock, and therefore. Eating is usually the thing for a diabetic. Let's not talk about eating.
Sure.
Okay, here's the rule for eating. The rule for eating, and it's fairly unusual that people need eating on Yom Kippur. There are a number of diseases which do require eating. Eating is as follows. 30 grams of food every 9 minutes. And again, if that is not enough, then the time can be reduced. And if the time has to be reduced to less than 4 minutes, it makes no sense to do that. You might as well just eat. Might as well just eat normally. And as far as the diabetic is concerned, diabetics should be able to calculate fairly carefully exactly how much is needed. One can figure out the amount of sugar and the amount of calories which are necessary. And if the amount which is necessary can be divided into portions of 30 grams or less, separated by at least 9 minutes, that would be the way to go. Now, of course, all of this has to do with eating and drinking. There are other ways of getting fluids and nutrition into the body. The other ways of getting fluid and nutrition into the body do not require eating. One can have fluids infused into a vein. That's not eating at all, and therefore no problem at all on Yom Kippur. Now, of course, establishing an IV line, putting the needle in to the vein in order to begin infusing fluids into the vein, inserting the needle is by itself a Torah prohibition, which would be permitted only in cases of life-saving. But if the patient is in a life-threatening situation, of course it would be permitted to insert the needle. Well, perhaps the patient already has a port which has been more or less permanently installed in order to be able to infuse fluids. Infusing fluids is no problem at all through the vein. And there are other parts of the body also which can be used to get fluids into the body.
You were talking about with someone who's on dialysis, most often they have,
more or less permanent port, and since the port is in place, so there's no prohibition at all on Yom Kippur in using that to infuse fluids. If you have to establish the IV line initially and insert the needle, then that's a Torah prohibition and can only be permitted.
Dialysis
is an osmosis machine which replaces kidney function.
And kidney
failure,
but he also has diabetes.
Oh, he also has a lot of stuff.
Diabetes, sugar. The biggest problem with, well, sugar has a lot of problems. One of the major problems with sugar is that it clogs up small blood veins, capillaries. Sugar. Sugar clogs up the capillaries, and therefore it really does a job on the kidneys, clogs up the kidneys. Other parts of the body too, you know, the retina in the back of the eye also has very fine blood vessels, which really get clogged up with sugar. That's what leads to blindness in diabetes patients. Diabetes has really horrible ramifications if it is not properly controlled. It's terribly important to keep diabetes under control. So what I've done is to summarize the basic principles of eating and drinking on Yom Kippur. The reason I emphasize this is because if heaven forbid, someone out there dies because they are incorrectly observing the mitzvah of Yom Kippur or Chametz on Pesach, or whatever the prohibition of the Torah might be, when in point of fact, they should be violating that prohibition in order to save themselves. If someone dies, chas v'shalom, heaven forbid, in a situation like this, well, something's got terribly wrong with the halacha, and that's what's important to have these ideas in mind. Okay, do you have any other issues about Yom Kippur which need to be discussed? Or I think that there are three kinds of. There are three kinds of injection. Injections can either be subcutaneous, tat ori, where the fluid is injected underneath the skin, intramuscular, toch shriri, where the fluid is injected into a muscle, where it's slowly absorbed by the body. These are only rabbinic prohibitions on Shabbat and Yom Tov. The third kind of injection is intravenous, where the fluid is injected directly into a vein. That's a Torah prohibition on Shabbos and Yom Tov, because in order to guarantee that the needle is properly seated in the vein, the only way to know that the needle is in the right place is for the doctor or the nurse to draw back the plunger and observe the blood coming into the barrel of the syringe. Now you know the needle is in the right place, and you can shoot in the medicine. drawing the blood out of the body is a Torah prohibition on Shabbos, and therefore intravenous injections are a Torah violation. If it's a port which has been more or less permanently installed, no prohibition at all in using that. Of course, for some reason, not entirely clear to me, subcutaneous infusion is not popular in hospitals in Israel and Europe today. I don't know exactly why it's not so popular, but glucose and saline can be infused into a patient's body very effectively with subcutaneous infusion. Easily 2 liters a day can be infused. It's a lot more comfortable for the patient. There are far fewer complications with the subcutaneous infusion. And since subcutaneous infusion is far more comfortable for the patient with far fewer complications, it's a little bit of a mystery to me why it's not done more frequently.
If one has a shalom has a bleeding ulcer, whether that would be before Yom Kippur, is one allowed to drink on Yom Kippur?
But bleeding ulcer, that could be very painful, you know? Not only painful, but fatal. The rule is as follows. Anyone who is suspected of having internal bleeding, bleeding anywhere inside the body, is a very serious medical condition. Anyone who is suspected of having internal bleeding, and that's exactly what you're talking about with your ulcer, any form of internal bleeding is medically a very serious but potentially fatal situation, and absolutely calls for a violation of Shabbos, Yom Kippur, or whatever in order to deal with that. And that's what should be done. Yes.
My question is a question of bathing in Yom Kippur. And obviously, like a full
bathing. We have no South Africans amongst us? He means bathing. In South Africa, it means something else. The bathing in South Africa means to go swimming. Bathing means to wash yourself.
Oh. In regards to bathing oneself. A shower is clearly prohibited, but let's say, somehow, there's, a mess or something like that.
Washing the skin, washing the body is one of the prohibitions of Yom Kippur, but it is the ta'anum, the pleasure of washing the body, which is prohibited. If the body has become dirty, some filth has attached itself to some part of the body, there's no objection at all to washing that off in the normal way. Of course, since Yom Kippur, this year it is really Shabbat, but even if it's during the week, it has all the halachot of Shabbat, so you can't use hot water, and Ashkenazim cannot use solid soap. You have to wash your body as you would on a Shabbat, with cold water, liquid soap. The example of the poskim is, since one does not wear shoes on Yom Kippur, if one walks through the mud, and now you've gotten home, you've gotten to shul, now you have mud on your feet and your legs because you weren't wearing shoes on Yom Kippur, well, it's okay to wash off the mud in the normal way. You just can't use hot water. You have to use cold water and soap and so on.
Now, my other question is, it's not like a life or death situation, but if someone has a really nasty cough or really nasty cold and they're on an antibiotic or some sort of medication that they've been taking prior to the beginning of Yom Kippur.
Why are they on an antibiotic?
I'm not an antibiotic. I just want to know.
Then why is this patient on an antibiotic?
Maybe it's an infection.
I hope so. I hope that's the only reason the antibiotic would be prescribed. And I hope the antibiotic is being prescribed for an infection which responds to this antibiotic, I hope. The rule is as follows. Remember I said before that any internal bleeding is life-threatening?
Mm-hmm.
The same is true regarding any internal infection. Now, nowadays, Baruch Hashem, in modern medicine, since World War II, we have a lot of antibiotics which do a great job, I hope. You know, the jury is still out on whether antibiotics are a great step forward in medical care, or are antibiotics just a disaster waiting to happen. It could be that the use, the widespread use of antibiotics, is just leading to the evolution is okay, it's understandable, yes? It could be that the widespread use of antibiotics is leading to the evolution of resistant bacteria, and if that's true, which very well might be true, we might be stuck with bacteria for which we have no treatment at all, that are much worse than what we started out with before we had antibiotics. It's possible that antibiotics are a disaster waiting to happen. But the rule is as follows. Nowadays, a wide range, a very wide range of medical conditions are considered trivial by modern physicians because they're so easily dealt with. A bottle of antibiotics is all you need and you'll be fine. These same conditions, as recently as 60 years ago, were often fatal. And people used to die from these conditions because they didn't have antibiotics. Just because the condition is easily dealt with does not mean that it's not life-threatening. Even though it's easily dealt with, it still is a threat to life if left untreated, and therefore any internal infection, definitely assuming that the internal infection responds to antibiotics, not all infections respond to antibiotics, but assuming that the infection is such that it responds to a specific antibiotic, it is correct to swallow that antibiotic on Yom Kippur, if one could do so without water, hinei matov, that would be good. If a small amount of water is required, the smallest amount should be used to swallow the pill.
So then, what about like a regular? I'm sorry, but what about a regular like? It's not an infection. It's just someone has like a really nasty cough, a really nasty cold, and they're taking like a Tylenol or a cough syrup or Robitussin.
Suffering builds moral fiber.
Build character.
What about? Yeah, you got it. It would be preferable to stay at home all day in bed and fast rather than go to shul. If going to shul is just going to make you feel worse and it make it more difficult to fast, it would be better to stay at home all day in bed. Fasting is what's really important.
I have a question regarding Mississippi.
I know those strings at the I know them.
Yeah. A couple things. One, if you decide to braid your own tzitzis, is there anything that you should be conscious of?
Sure.
And two, if you decide to start wearing your tzitzis at night to sleep in, is it okay to have a pair that you sleep in? Because if you want to wear tzitzis, the mitzvah is to wear it every moment of the day. So if you wake up after dawn, you should have tzitzis on. So is it okay to designate a pair to sleep in and change into them at night and then change out of them when you get dressed after mikvah or whatever, and then go on your day? So
yeah, one thing at a time. When you say making your own tzitzis, you mean buying the threads ready-made and tying them, or are you talking about making the threads?
No. Buying the
rule is as follows. It's not difficult to learn how to tie your own tzitzis. They're different minhagim about exactly how to do the knots and the windings. Everyone should follow his own minhag. Whatever minhag you're following, it's not difficult to learn how to do it, and therefore it's worthwhile to learn how to do it yourself, not be dependent on other people. The tying of the tzitzis onto the garment must be done l'shem mitzvah. One must have in mind that one is doing it for the mitzvah purpose. If you're just practicing, that's no mitzvah at all, and the talis katan is talis katan, talis gadol is invalid. The mitzvahs, the tzitzis have not been properly tied. If you think you're just practicing, you have to have in mind that you're doing it for the mitzvah, and you should say the words in Yiddish or Hebrew or English. You should speak out the words before you start. Say, I am tying these tzitzis for the purpose of the mitzvah, so that I will be able to do the mitzvah. You should speak out the words. If you failed to speak out the words, as long as you had it in mind, that is sufficient. But you should actually speak out the words, and then you begin, and then you begin to work. Now, as far as nighttime is concerned, there's a big machlokas, a big controversy amongst the Rishonim on tzitzis at night. The Gemara says that tzitzis is a daytime mitzvah, not a nighttime mitzvah. The two different ways of understanding the Gemara are as follows. Around half of the great authorities, around half of the poskim, understand that what the Gemara means is that at night there's simply no mitzvah of tzitzis at all, and during the day there is a mitzvah. The other half of the poskim understand the Gemara a little bit differently. They understand that a garment which is primarily intended for nighttime wearing is exempt from tzitzis, even if you will wear it during the day. And a garment which is intended for daytime use requires tzitzis and has a mitzvah of tzitzis, even if you will wear it at night. Now, since the poskim among the Rishonim in the Middle Ages were more or less evenly divided on this issue, the Shulchan Aruch decides that we should be machmir, we should be strict, and follow both approaches simultaneously. And therefore, if you have a daytime garment which you are wearing at night, it absolutely should have, absolutely must have tzitzis on it, but if you put it on at night, we will not recite a blessing, because the other opinion holds there's no mitzvah at all during the night. And similarly, a nighttime garment which you put on during the day should still have tzitzis on it, because one opinion holds that as long as it's daytime, there is a mitzvah. But since the other opinion holds that the nighttime garment is exempt from tzitzis, if you happen to put it on during the day, no blessing should be recited on that. In order to recite the blessing, you need a daytime garment which is being worn during the day. If you have your daytime garment on through the night, you slept in it, which is quite possible, and indeed, as you correctly point out, probably desirable, so you'll have tzitzis on when you wake up. If you didn't put on the tzitzis during the day, you had them on from the previous night, then when you make the bracha, you should hold on to the threads. Normally you make the blessing when you put on the tzitzis. Well, if you didn't put them on because you already were wearing it from the previous night, you should at least hold on to the tzitzis when you make the blessing. Dare I mention a non-Chabad practice? It might be important for you to be aware of a non-Chabad approach so that you will not think badly of people whom you encounter who might be following other minhagim. Rav Moshe Feinstein and following him, many other great poskim nowadays reason as follows. If at nighttime you have taken off your talis katan, for example, to take a shower or for any other reason, then you should not put it back on again at night, because according to these rabbis, and I emphasize this is not a Chabad approach, right? According to these rabbis, if you take a shower at night, you take off your talis katan to shower. Now, if you put the talis katan back on again, you are placing yourself in the middle of a suffix, in the middle of a doubtful case, in the middle of a machloket poskin. Should you make the bracha or should you not make the bracha? Bottom line, the decision will be no bracha because it's nighttime. But Rav Moshe and the other another poskim reason, why should you put yourself into a doubtful situation? Surely halacha demands that we avoid as much as possible doubtful situations, and therefore it would be better, according to them, not to put the talus back on. So you might very well encounter guys who are following that view. There's, of course, nothing wrong with people following whichever view they choose to follow.
I like the health issue question. I got another one for you.
Health, yes.
Yeah.
Health is terribly important.
Mild skin irritations, whether that be a rash or even a bug bite, are you allowed to apply ointment?
In general, it's a problem. It's a problem. Well, let me first speak about Shabbat in general, and then Yom Kippur in specific. Applying creams, lotions to the skin on Shabbat is possibly a problem of nimareyach. Nimareyach is part of leather working. Leather working is one of the prohibitions of Shabbat and Yom Kippur as well. Leather working, a part of the prohibition would be nimareyach, adding a smooth layer of cream or anything else over another surface. Adding a smooth layer of anything on top of the surface is the prohibition of nimareyach. Poskim speak endlessly about the question of whether one is allowed to smooth butter on a piece of bread on Shabbat, or whether one is allowed to smooth avocado on a piece of bread on Shabbat. Poskim speak endlessly about this issue because there is a prohibition of smoothing any surface. As far as the food is concerned, most poskim are lenient, some are strict even on that. Things which are going to be going to be eaten, most hold it's okay. Most poskim prohibit. Are we all Ashkenazim? What I'm about to say has to do with Ashkenazim and not Sfaradim. Ashkenaz poskim prohibit toothpaste on Shabbos because, you know, toothpaste they have in your country? Toothpaste? Yes? If you use toothpaste, what you are doing is smoothing a layer of toothpaste over the teeth and gums, and that's Nimarech. Ashkenaz poskim prohibit that. Now here comes the analysis. The Ramah says in the Shulchan Aruch that if you are walking along outside, it is permitted to step on rok, on spit. If someone spit on the ground, not on the sidewalk, on the earth, on the dirt, you have to step on that as you walk along. That's what it says in the Shulchan Aruch. The Magen Avraham and the great poskim ask the following question: why should that be permitted? If you step on the rok, if you step on the spit, you are smoothing it out. Shouldn't that be the prohibition of nivareach on Shabbos? The answer is, it's okay, kevan shekavanato lehavlia, because what you're doing is causing the spit to be absorbed by the earth. The prohibition is adding a smooth layer on top of the surface. If what you're doing is causing absorption of the liquid into the earth, then it's okay. It follows, therefore, that there are two kinds of creams, two kinds of lotions, and you can experiment during the week and see what kind you have. Some creams and lotions are rubbed into the skin. Others are rubbed on the skin.
For example, like
calamine
lotion that's on the skin.
Calamine lotion which remains on the skin, prohibited on Shabbos and Yom Tov. There are thousands of examples out there of lotions and creams. You can experiment during the week, see whether if it's absorbed by the skin. You're rubbing it in, fine.
This is not for skin irritations, but let's say like cocoa butter, that's absorption.
Yeah, Tom said, I'm not familiar with different things, but if it's not obvious to you whether your cream or lotion is absorbed into the skin or remains on the surface, if it's not obvious to you, you can do a little experiment. Try to rub it in, and after you've tried to rub it in, touch your skin to a clean glass. Look at the glass and see whether or not the cream is transferred to the glass. If so, you know it's remained on the surface. If it's absorbed, so you're not going to get the transfer onto the glass.
Then you have a problem of how much you use. If you use too much and it's too much, saturated,
then you'll be in trouble. Then you'll be in trouble. So you have to be careful how you use it. Now, that's how Anshar is. So if you have a skin condition requiring... But if you know that so much is not going to be absorbed, you're putting on so much in it, so you can't say it's covered by Kavanah Avliya. You have to be honest. You have to be honest about how much you're using, right? Well, there's always Kavanah Tola Avliya. Let's go one step. That's on ordinary Shabbos. If you have, therefore, a skin condition, and you're using a certain cream to take care of your skin condition, experiment with it and see whether it is usable on Shabbat. If it's not usable on Shabbat, according to these criteria, you can go to the drugstore, to the chemist, and see whether or not you can get the same active ingredient in a different formulation, with different inactive ingredients mixed with it. Perhaps you can get the same medicine in a different formulation, which will indeed be absorbed by the skin. That all of this is on Shabbos. We haven't done Yom Kippur yet.
No.
Now, as far as creams on Yom Kippur are concerned, even creams and lotions which are permitted on Shabbos are prohibited on Yom Kippur. And on Yom Kippur, the prohibition is because of ta'anug, the pleasure of anointing the skin. Back in those days, it was very common for people to anoint their skin with oil for ta'anug, for pleasure, and that's prohibited on Yom Kippur. And still today, people use a wide variety of creams and lotions with ta'anug for pleasure. It's prohibited. If, however, the cream or lotion is being applied for medical purposes, lirafua, therapeutically, then that's permitted on Yom Kippur. So the number one, we must distinguish between what's absorbed, that's lenient, and what stays on the skin, that's always prohibited on Shabbos and Yom Kippur. If it's absorbed in the skin, on Shabbos no problem, on Yom Kippur no problem if it's therapeutic. If it's therapeutic.
It's okay. I have two questions.
Okay.
The one that I really want to know is. Okay, this is a pretty specific question. So, I was reading the Shulchan Aruch, was talking about like laws of modesty and all these different things and context in the laboratory. Okay, so if somebody like decides to that they're going to get dressed in the bathroom, that they're not going to get dressed like in their room or anything like that, just in the bathroom. They've taken a shower and there's like water all over the floor, and they know that like every time that they try to like put their pants on or something like that. They have to like do gymnastics, which is like a balancing act, because I'm like they don't want to get water on their pants and they'll be in a huge mess. So, but there's a bathroom. There's like rows of bathrooms, and the one next door is dry. It's a dry floor, and it'd be fine. They wouldn't have to like walk on eggshells for this. Would it be an issue of modesty to be like wearing a towel around like the way that a guy would usually wear a towel, and to exit the bathroom with the shower? Go into the dry bathroom so that they can put their pants on.
Yeah, maybe. Might be okay. The rule is as follows. What is immodest and therefore wrong is a form of conduct, a mode of behavior which is unusual in the place you happen to be at the moment and therefore focuses everyone's attention upon you. In the Gemara distinguishes between different rooms in the bathhouse. There's the outer room where everyone's dressed. There's the middle room where some people are dressed and some people are undressed. There's the inner room where the bath actually is, where everyone is undressed. The idea is that as long as your form of behavior is normal in the place you happen to be at the moment, and therefore you're not going to focus everyone's attention upon yourself, it's fine. What is the truth in the hallway, in the corridor, which you describe, with the different doors going to the different bathrooms? I have no idea. Once you establish the facts, either such a behavior, walking with just a towel around your waist, is normal, not going to attract anyone's attention, fine, and there's no modesty issue. Okay?
Back to the tzitzit. On my talis, on the tzitzit, there's like some kind of glue on the end or something. It's like hard on the end, like stuff from praying. So I was wondering if that was it came like that. I was wondering if that was a problem. On regular tzitzit, like to stop it praying or whatever, can you put something on the end to
I'm not happy with the idea. I'm not happy with the idea of putting a drop of glue on the end of the tzitzit in order to prevent fraying. English is such a mysterious language. Everyone knows that flammable and inflammable means the same thing. Unraveling is called in the cloth industry raveling. Raveling and unraveling also means the same thing. Quite mysterious, no? In any event, I'm unhappy with using glue to prevent the fraying or unraveling or raveling of the tzitzis, but it surely does not passel. It surely does not disqualify the tzitzis. The mitzvah is still the mitzvah. If you want my advice would not be to do it, but if it's been done, the tzitzis are surely kosher and the mitzvah is 100% okay.
Why is your advice not to do it?
Because it's not naturally part of the tzitzis.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it also applies if you use it as a nail.
Nail polish would be the same thing.
Is there a problem with using spray deodorant on Shabbos or Yom Kippur?
No. Spray should be okay. Liquid, roll-ons are typically liquid. I think all roll-ons are liquid as far as I know. Liquid or spray is okay. The problem would be the solid deodorants, which are typically the sticks. You also have these gels, which are sort of hard to tell whether it's solid or liquid. If it's not clearly a liquid or a spray, I would stay away from it. And therefore, gels, I'm a little bit shaky in my mind about what the status of the gel is, whether it's liquid or solid. The rule is exactly as Mrs. Cohen taught us in the third grade. Just as Mrs. Cohen taught us, so the poskim teach us, liquids are things which can be poured from one container to another and take the shape of the container. Solids do not. I cannot speak here about all the gels which are out there on the market. They all have different viscosities, I suppose, and which are liquids and which are solids, I'm not in a position to say at the moment. If it's not burdensome, use a liquid or use a spray. And
you can spray it even on the
clothes? No, only on the body. Okay. Do we have any other issues which have to be discussed? Yes.
Under the
Rav Avadia Yosef is in charge of it.
According to
Ashkenazi, Rav Avadia Yosef is in charge of the Beit Yosef Hechsher, a wide variety of food products, including meat. Many restaurants in Yerushalayim and all over Israel are under the supervision. It is a splendid hashkacha, superb Hechsher, and no doubt entirely satisfactory for Sfaradim. Your question is, of course, whether it's okay for Ashkenazim as well.
For milk and for bread products, I know it's fine.
Oh, yes? I didn't know. It could be. It's probably true. If I said it, it's true.
But you're not sure. And you're unsure if to use it on meat.
Yeah, yeah, the issue is as follows. I have personally asked the people who are actually in charge of Beit Yosef whether or not they take into account Ashkenaz Chumrot. And sometimes the Ashkenaz person is stricter than the Sephardic. Sometimes the Sephardic is stricter than the Ashkenaz. You know, like every page in the Shulchan Aruch has disagreements between the Sephardic and Ashkenaz poskim. There's no way to predict in any particular issue who's going to be stricter, the Ashkenaz or the Sephardic poskim. And I've not been successful in getting the people who run the Beit Yosef Heksher to actually certify that they are acceptable for Ashkenaz Chumras as well. And therefore, I do not know as a fact that it's okay for Ashkenazim. The truth is, I would be very surprised. I would be very, very surprised if there is a problem for Ashkenazim. After all, I know that many of the Shochatim are actually Ashkenazim. And I know that even the Sephardic Shochatim who were trained in a program that covers both Ashkenaz and Sephardic approaches. I'd be very surprised if there's a problem, but I cannot state as a fact that the meat is okay.
Then that's still
tough. Unless you can find out information better than I have, I don't know. So, as far as I know, it's still a Suffolk. It doesn't mean that you are unable to resolve that Suffolk through your own investigations. Maybe it really is okay. I'd be surprised if it's a problem.
They don't have like in America, they have like a person who has a phone and has questions.
Yes, I've asked them enough. I've asked them in person. I've asked them by fax. I've asked them. I sent them a letter by snail mail. I never got a response.
Somebody told me that the Levite is very proud of it.
Zehu, that's why it was all started. It was all started as an expression of Sephardi pride. And therefore, although it probably is okay for Ashkenazim, they don't want to say that.
I understand. No, I mean, all the Shastim are trained the same way. It's very likely.
Yeah, I'd be very surprised if there's a problem. But I don't know the facts. Yeah.
I have an easy question. Question is on Kulisha. So I'm a musician, that's sort of like my livelihood, whatever. How far can the leniencies go in terms of me listening to metal voices? Like, in terms of, I know if it's for work purposes, I've heard of people getting customers that they can like listen to people's like recordings, but like, what if it's just for enjoyment? Like, it's a Sunday afternoon stroll and I want to like listen to, I don't know, Joni Mitchell or something.
Joni Mitchell.
That's in respect.
There's not much room for leniency. The tiny room which does exist for leniency, and I emphasize the following opinion, is really a small minority view of the poskim, and therefore the following leniency, which I'm about to outline, be good advice not to rely upon the following leniency. But there are people out there who are relying upon the following leniency of the Sridi Yesh, Rav Yechiel Michal Weinberg. Rav Weinberg was the last of the great Rabbanim of Europe after the Holocaust. All the other great poskim either having been killed by the Nazis or ended up in other places outside of Europe. He was the last in Europe in the 1950s after the Holocaust. He, Bikoshi, with great difficulty, found a little bit of room to be lenient for guys, for men, to hear the singing voice of women in a ma'amad shel kedusha, in kedusha situations. For example, the example he was dealing with were boys and girls who were together at a Shabbaton singing Shabbos Mirs. That he found some little room to permit because of the kedusha nature of the event. aside from this, you won't find the healing.
What about the microphone exception? An exception of the microphone
from your
voice?
Rav Avadia, whom we just mentioned before, and the following is not an Ashkenaz Sephardi thing, in a halacha, which is a subject of machlokas between the Ashkenazim and the Sephardim, so each is going to want to follow the rabbis on their team. But in an issue which is not a machlokas between, not a disagreement between Sephardic and Ashkenaz poskim, so there's no particular reason why Ashkenazim should not be influenced by what the Sephardic rabbis say, or the other way around. The following issue is not a Sephardic Ashkenaz division. Rav Avadia holds as follows: what is prohibited is to hear the live voice of the woman, the disembodied voice. It's only the voice without the body. For example, on a record, on a radio, or whatever. If the body of the woman is not present, only the voice, and further, one does not have in mind a picture of the way the woman looks, and therefore you have only the voice and no mental image of what she looks like, or she's not standing in front of you, so you don't see what she looks like. According to Rav Avadia, this is permitted. He's a heavyweight. Posek, and there are many of them who are following that.
That's good. Like if I have a recording.
Maria Callas, and you don't know what she looks like, and her picture is not on the front of the album, you're okay.
Okay, but like if my friend, he's a singer-songwriter, I absolutely know what she looks like. And he's like, hey, listen to my new song.
Wouldn't help. Now, there are a few Poskim, and I emphasize again that this is a small minority view, and therefore, in general, not advisable to rely upon. There are some Poskim out there who hold that if it's a non-Jewish woman, it should be okay. And there are also a small number of Poskim, once again, not advisable to rely upon an unusual view that if the woman is dead, it's okay. The majority view. The majority view of the post can hold that what is or is not erotically stimulating doesn't depend upon whether the woman is still alive or not. Looking at her photograph either is or is not an erotic event. It has nothing to do with whether she's still alive. That's what most post can hold.
I have a very random question for you.
Fire away.
Okay. Is there any text that alludes to a logo or colors of a flag for Mashiach?
Is a flag Mashiach?
What an interesting question.
Well, I ask because I would figure that if there were colors or a logo, that it would be purple. Because in ancient times, purple was really the sign of royalty. I don't know why some Chabadniks chose to use yellow and red, but that's regardless of the point. I'm not even thinking about that. Is there a logo or a color of Mashiach?
Not to my knowledge, but feel free to investigate this elsewhere. Perhaps you'll find an answer. I do not know of an answer.
Would you know where to start?
Okay.
Google. People.
The number of Sfarim, which has been published recently within Chabad or outside of Chabad, the number of Sfarim which have been published recently, which are Likutim, collections of material about Mashiach. There are a number of such Chabad Sfarim, and that's where I would begin looking. But if you find out anything, let me know.
Are there any other kashrus? Any other kashrus nomos or changes or most of the regular shkachas of the regular ma'arim shkachas are fine?
The regular Mahadran hashkachas remain fine. The controversies which surround them are entirely of a political nature and not halachic. These are fine. Of course, everyone is entitled to his political position.
I see this certain restaurants, which I've noticed that Beziers is far more in town than it ever was before. There's a lot more restaurants taking it. And there's fewer restaurants taking it. Good than in town. Good used to be more in town. So they seem like they're taking their government might have in your saliva is still reliable.
Yes, enough. Okay, it's okay. Okay.
Do all these plastics, all these microscopics have machines of chlamydia, or
depends. It depends. If we're talking about a restaurant which has non-Torah observant or non-Jewish workers, then indeed they insist upon a permanent on-site mashgiach. If we're talking about a falafel stand where there's just, you know, one guy doing it and he is himself Torah observant, it's sufficient to have a mashgiach come and go occasionally.
If you go outside of Israel and you want to rely on the kosher list, like they have in many European countries, issued by the main rabbinate. And how can you distinguish if something is good enough for you if you keep Mehatman or if you keep Rabbanot?
No way to know. If you have certain chumrot, there's no way to know whether a given product outside of Israel, which is on the rabbinic list, meets your requirements or not. The only way to know is to ask whoever is responsible for giving the hechter, tell her that you're looking for such and such a chumrah, and he'll tell you whether or not it's incorporated into the specific product that you're interested in.
Unless it's indicated on the list, you know.
If he says, but you can ask him, and he'll tell you. The Mahadran Hechsher in Eretz Yisrael are all machmir on Chol of Yisrael. They, for example, do not allow milk powder from Chutz La'aretz, which is controversial. Some people say it is Chol of Yisrael, some people say not. But the Mahadran Hechsher in Israel all take a machmir position, strict position on Chol of Yisrael. It should be no problem with that.
Just to answer my question, if Rabbanut is good enough for you, then you can take all that on the kosher list?
Correct. Since the ordinary Rabbanut in Israel has no chumrot, therefore someone who is relying upon the Rabbanut in Israel is a person who has decided not to follow any chumrot, any stricter positions, and then the ordinary kashrus abroad is surely sufficient for such a person. So we have time for one more question.
About something that happened in Gaza, the Kiev Talit, that is not, the knots are not parted as I follow. So how do I, can I change that in Talit?
Yes, you can untie the whole thing and tie
it
again. But of course you should say. You should say the words that you're doing it for the Kedusha, the mitzvah of Titus. You have to at least have that in mind. You should say the words as well. So I wish you all a tzom mo'il, a good Yom Kippur, a gemach simateva, a good Yom Tov, good Shabbos, and kol tov.
Thank you.